From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. China's peaceful rise is good for the world and it's good for America. The words of President Obama during this week's formal state visit by Chinese President Hu Jintao. This hour, we explore facets of U.S.-China relations with several guests, including Iowa State University political science professor Dick Monsbach. Chad Hart, also from ISU, will join us to talk about agricultural exports to China. And Ken Statler of Rockwell Collins will tell us about that company's expansion in China. Do you see China as a partner or a competitor? Our conversation starts right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As Chinese President Hu Jintao winds up his visit to the U.S. this week, we want to explore facets this hour of the U.S., China, and its relations with several guests. And later in the hour, Chad Hart will join us from Iowa State University. He'll talk about agricultural exports to China, of course, a key interest in our agricultural state. Also, Ken Statler of Rockwell Collins will tell us about that company's expansion in China, learning about that in our second half hour. Though, first of all, for perspective on the politics of this visit, we're joined by Iowa State University political science professor Dick Monsbach. Professor Monsbach, welcome to our program.
Many thanks indeed. Enjoy being here.
And we want to reach out to our listeners this hour, as we'll be focusing on the U.S.-China relationship the entire hour. We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts, your questions, your concerns, perhaps even fears or hopes as you see the rise of China and its relations to the U.S.? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Twitter. Give us a tweet at IPR Talk. Here's President Hu speaking through an interpreter at a joint news conference on Wednesday of this week about the nature of the cooperation he would like to see between the U.S. and his country.
Our cooperation as partners should be based on mutual respect. We live in an increasingly diverse and colorful world. China and the United States should respect each other's choice of development path and each other's core interests.
Speaking through an interpreter, President Hu of China. Professor Monsbach, what is your reaction to this visit after a year of tense relations? What did it accomplish?
I'm delighted he finally made it. Hu Jintao, of course, is leaving office. And what you heard were platitudes and generalizations. And one can only hope that his successors, in the next couple of years will, in fact, echo the same sentiments. The problem, of course, with China, if I can put problem in quotes, is that historically we're now one of what we could call the G2. The United States is a declining superpower. China is a rising superpower. It depends on the way you look at history and international relations to make any reasonable prediction, and I'm not sure one can. Historically, this is a period that we call hegemonic conflict, potential hegemonic conflict and hegemonic rivalry. It has led to major wars in the past. The most perhaps best known is the rise of Germany in the late 19th century and the decline of Britain, and which culminated, of course, in World War I. On the other hand, Britain peacefully surrendered its global leadership to this country after World War I, and you could call that a hegemonic exchange. Of course, the world is not the late 19th century. The nature of disputes is different. The Chinese are as difficult to negotiate with as any group of people in the world. They are really hard-headed negotiators. The list of differences is long. Whether, in fact, those differences can either be frozen or bridged remains to be seen. Before the program, I started doing a list of issues on the agenda, and I'm still doing it as we started. But, I mean, these range from economic, which, of course, we'll be discussing later. China last year became Past Japan is the second largest economy in the world behind the United States. Past Germany as the world's leading exporter in the world. And so we're getting to the point where what used to be said of the United States, that is, when the American economy sneezes, the rest of the world catches pneumonia, can also be said of China. The fluctuations, for example, in the New York Stock Exchange are frequently the result of expectations that China will or will not increase interest rates. On the agenda of differences, we have the environment. China has now become the world's leading source of carbon emissions, and Chinese-American cooperation in this area is absolutely critical. It's absolutely vital if we're going to get anywhere. And I'm very doubtful about that.
Give us a little bit more of the Chinese perspective. We hear a lot in our media about our perspective vis-a-vis China, and you cast us as one declining superpower, the United States, in the face of a rising superpower. So what are their concerns?
Well, I think China's at least persuaded of this decline, and let me be parenthetical about that. Same thing was said of Japan in the 1990s, and of course it never happened, and it may not happen in the case of China. But I think China's major concern is, and they've articulated it, is one, their fear that the United States is seeking to contain them. This is precisely what the Germans were fearful of at the beginning of the 20th century. And so the United States, of course, has warmed relations dramatically with China's major regional rival, India. The United States is also involved in, of course, Pakistan and Afghanistan. In the former Soviet states of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, etc., where we and the Chinese are involved, we're involved together in Mongolia. The United States has, this is an interesting sort of little historical footnote, has warmed relations dramatically with Vietnam, which has been a traditionally, shall we say, hostile party on China's southern border. The Chinese were very upset when last year, as verbal conflict increased over the fate of the offshore islands claimed by both China and by Southeast Asia and Japan, the Senkakus and the other islands in that region, the Parakels, when the United States, in fact, offered to mediate the dispute, to get involved in the dispute, and this was seen by the Chinese as involvement in territorial affairs of great importance to them. And the most important of those territorial affairs are, of course, Taiwan and Tibet, on which the Chinese and Americans view the situations dramatically differently. We have an agreement with the Chinese, concluded way back in the 1970s, that there would be a single China. But the United States, of course, acts in ways to help maintain the at least de facto independence of that island. Americans also, of course, are at least vociferous about Chinese oppression of Tibetan nationalism. And so these are the immediate issues. And then it gets more significant as we move a little further away. For example, as we move from the direct Chinese interest to North Korea. North Korea is, I think, one of the two most dangerous flashpoints in global politics today, the other being Iran. And although it did appear, and you asked about this meeting, it did appear that in recent weeks that China has indeed begun to move in the direction that the Americans are seeking, which is to act firmly in the face of repeated North Korean provocations and the continued production of nuclear materials, including a recent revelation that indeed there's an entirely previously unknown nuclear facility. China seems to have been influenced recently by the Obama administration. We just learned this. The Obama administration essentially said, look, you have either got to begin to rein North Korea, and China is the only country that really is in a position to do that, short of war, Or else the United States is going to have to rethink its military options, including strengthening American forces in Asia, in South Korea, in Japan, in general, making its military presence more significant and more visible in China's eyes. So these are some of the issues. And, of course, I haven't even really touched on the economic quarrels, the claims of Chinese management of currency, market access, intellectual property, and the like. So these are all serious and real differences. But I don't see, unlike, if I may make a go back to my original comparison of the late 19th century, I don't see any of these issues as having the same kinds of inevitable, shall we say, military confrontation that the issues of the late 19th century ultimately had for the adversaries at that time. So, you know, I think it can be dealt with, but we, certainly this country, has had little experience in doing so. I mean, America, as to put it bluntly, has been top dog now for a century. And so we've really had little to be concerned about.
And yet, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman John Kerry, Senator Kerry, said the past year has been challenging for U.S.-China relations. And in his words, despite the shared gains achieved working together on global concerns, many in Congress believe the United States and China are on a collision course. And he goes on to say it's critical that leaders in both countries don't allow mutual suspicions to degenerate into fear-mongering and demagoguery. Now, I'm wondering which groups are most suspicious, most fearful of China's motives in our country?
Well, that's a very good question. On the one hand, I mean, I think it's a multifarious set of groups for different reasons. For example, liberals are, shall we say, constantly concerned about China's human rights record. And historically have wanted us to link that human rights record to economic relations. American economic interests, labor unions, for example, are terribly upset, of course, about the continued outsourcing of American jobs to China, about the allegations of, shall we say, Chinese violations of WTO trade regulations, parenthetically. The Chinese have every reason to be upset by American violations of trade regulations. So trade's a hot issue, as is currency for that reason. But my main sense is that those in Congress, I think, are simply concerned because they've never had to deal with the fact that there is a potential rival of some significance, or at least not since the Cold War. And in a real sense, one could argue, and I'm not going to make this argument here, that the Cold War was the result of mutual suspicion and mutual misunderstanding rather than any inevitable collision. I mean, that's we don't need to go back, half a century. But in effect, for the last, after the end of the Cold War, the United States was the unipolar leader of the world, and it was expected it would remain this way. And in a relatively short period of time, China has emerged as a significant player. Not as significant, I think, as those to whom you refer think it is. China is not a serious military threat to this country. China's nuclear forces are modest, very modest. China has developed a significant regional military capacity in East Asia and is expanding that, especially in relation to India. But there's no, in my judgment, immediate problems on the horizon that ought to trigger this. But I think it's a natural reaction to the fact, look, there's a competition to be number one. And I think there's a fright that Chinese investments, for example, in military hardware, China's involvement in areas of the world which the United States regards as governed by despots and extremists ranging from North Korea to the Sudan, China's the competition with China for raw materials, oil, for example, and in Africa and elsewhere. These are all the sorts of things that upset legislators in a country that has become accustomed to being number one and being treated as number one. And so I think it's as much psychological as it is due to any particular issue that that separates the two countries.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking this hour with Iowa State University political science professor Dick Monsbach. We're talking about U.S.-China relations in light of this week's visit by Chinese President Hu Jintao, and that visit winding up at the end of this week here. Going back to your earlier point of human rights, always a point of contention between the U.S. and China, here's President Hu speaking through an interpreter at a joint news conference this Wednesday after encountering a fresh barrage of criticism about human rights.
China is a developing country with a huge population and also a developing country in a crucial stage of reform. In this context, China still faces many challenges in economic and social development, and a lot still needs to be done in China in terms of human rights. We will continue our efforts to improve the lives of the Chinese people, and we will continue our efforts to promote democracy and the rule of law in our country.
How significant is that acknowledgement and his saying that they would continue to improve human rights?
Well, between you, me, and the wall and your listeners, I think that was simply blather for the American public. The Chinese Communist Party has no intention, in my judgment, of loosening its hold. There have been conflicts within the Chinese leadership. And I think one of the points you asked me just before this, to what extent and why were certain elements in this country hostile to or concerned about China? The same question has to be asked about China. And so what we're dealing with in China today is not simply a rising power, but a country that, A, is the site of intensifying nationalism. The Communist Party of China has manipulated nationalism at home and is also essentially moved by it. Chinese are becoming more articulate. Chinese hackers, whether government employed or otherwise, have been involved repeatedly in cyber attacks on this country. We don't know how autonomous they are. The Chinese government structure is opaque. That is to say, it's very difficult to see who represents what, no pun intended. That which bureaucratic agencies are pushing for warmer relations, which individuals in the Chinese Politburo would like to see an improvement in both human rights and in welfare conditions in that country. This is very difficult for us to make out. It reminds me of the old days of Kremlinology. You're trying to kind of study the entrails of some sacrificed animal to make predictions, because we don't know. I mean, there was the recent event, which all the American newspapers picked up, was quite fascinating, on the occasion of Secretary of Defense Gates' visit to Beijing, when the secretary, while in Beijing, knew of a test flight of the Chinese stealth aircraft, and apparently President Hu did not. And so increasingly there's speculation that the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, have one policy. The president of China, who, by the way, compared to his predecessors, is a relatively weak figure, and as I said earlier, is in any event due to leave office. This is no Deng Xiaoping. Hu Jintao is no Deng Xiaoping. So we think the leadership is fractured to some extent. This is not the world of Mao Zedong, by any stretch of the imagination. That creates problems because you're not exactly sure, A, whom you're negotiating with, B, whether the person or persons you're negotiating with, in fact, can carry out what they say, and C, whether they really want to, and what's going to be the result of bureaucratic battles back home. To some extent that, by the way, the Chinese must be just as perplexed about the American system.
We saw a lot of pageantry during this week for the Chinese state visit. From President Obama's perspective, his goals, were they met? What were they?
I think they were modest. I think the most important goals had been, of course, to open Chinese markets further. I think in addition, and he succeeded there as far as certainly he got the announcements he wanted with with commitments of $40+ billion for American corporations. I think a little noticed and very significant announcement was the Chinese government was, in effect, no longer going to insist, as they had recently, on what they called indigenous innovation in products sold in China, which is another way of saying they were going to let the Americans have some role, at least in, for example, high-tech, energy-efficient sorts of things. But the question is that more representative of China, or is the fact that the Chinese government is exerting ever more control over the so-called sale of rare metals, so critical from everything from electric motors to windmills, to modern windmills. We don't know, and we don't know who represents it. I think, though, that the president got a real lift. I think the pageantry was quite in order. What he was saying, the message was, of course, we respect you as an equal. I think this is terribly important to China, not just to President Hu Jintao, but to China. And I think in that sense, and I think in this sense, in this respect, by the way, I kind of would applaud the president, what he has been doing is essentially saying, we are partners, we are equals. And I think the Chinese want to hear this. And I think it's the most significant and best way to assuage Chinese nationalism. Now, the other one of the aspects of the communique, the joint communique, that's absolutely fascinating, is the listing of issues very clearly on which the two parties cannot agree. And I think that's fine.
We have a break in about a minute or two, but quickly summarize what's on that list that you found interesting.
Among the most interesting was Taiwan, the allusion to, as I said, the offshore islands earlier, the ways in which to approach the environmental issues, and indeed, as you just suggested, human rights and democracy, what President Obama referred to, and the Chinese understand this very well, as the notion of, quote, universal rights at Korea. I think the president got most of what he wanted. They would have loved to have had some kind of comment, I'm sure, on the question of whether China manages the yuan, its currency, mm-hmm. by linking it to the dollar. But they knew they weren't going to get that. So that was left unsaid, and I think that was fine.
Now, going back to human rights, we hear so often that some of the disagreement over human rights comes from the fact that China defines human rights differently than we do in the U.S. How much is that alternative view, alternative definition of human rights a valid point to make?
Well,
or simply some spin?
It's a substantive point. The West, in general, advocates, it's a long tradition going way, way back. I won't burden you with it.
We have about 30 seconds before we break.
Believes in the universality of human rights. Every human being has the same rights. China and a number of other countries believe in what they call cultural relativism, which is each society grants human rights. There are no such things as universal human rights.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Iowa State University political science professor Dick Mansbach, giving us analysis on the Chinese president's visit to the United States this week. What are your thoughts, questions, concerns as you see the rise of China? We want to have you in our conversation. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, joining us as well, Chad Hart of Iowa State University, assistant professor of economics, Kent Statler, executive vice president and chief operating officer of commercial systems at Rockwell Collins. We'll hear about new developments there when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And The Exchange continues here on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and great to have you with us over the noon hour as we look at the Chinese-American relationship in light of the visit by the Chinese president to the U.S. this week. Dick Mansbach is with us, Iowa State University political science professor. Also joining us now, Chad Hart, assistant professor of economics at Iowa State University. Chad Hart, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben. Pleasure to be here.
And also Kent Statler, the executive vice president and chief operating officer of commercial systems at Rockwell Collins, joining us by phone. Kent, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Alex.
Ben, Ben Kiefer.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Kent, hold on a minute. I want to reach out to our listeners and ask for their thoughts, questions, and concerns about China, especially as we focus on business between China and the U.S. this hour. 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. First to you, Kent Statler. China's president came to Washington bearing gifts, solidified orders for 200 Boeing 737s and also a number of 777s, a list price value of $19 billion. Will that have any impact on business at Rockwell Collins?
Well, we continue to see a dramatic recovery across all of our markets, in particular in strength in the air transport market that the 737s and the 777s fall within. The majority of the orders that the president announced really were orders that we had already seen and competed for the airline-specific unique equipment, and we have fared very, very well in China. So that has, if you will, been baked into our current forecast that we're presenting to both the financial community and also to the media as well. So, again, a very robust economy. Things it does help seeing that type of support from that key growing area in the global marketplace, and was just another, I think, positive sign of what we're seeing across the aerospace industry.
Mm-hmm. When we look at that $19 billion figure, even though you say it was baked into the formula earlier on, is there a number there you can give us that is attached to Rockwell Collins?
You know, it really depends on which airline at the end of the day is going to take ownership of the airline that's being delivered. But I think we can look at that and say it is a large number and a material number to Rockwell Collins.
Many people are not aware of or not aware of the extent of Rockwell Collins' activity actually in China. Tell us, summarize the current state of your involvement in China, with China.
I think that's a great question, and Rockwell Collins has been in China now for over 25 years. We started back when we were part of Rockwell International in the 1980s, and we continue to grow that presence. We're in five locations there. We do everything from sales offices to manufacturing, joint ventures through the service and support side, and really have leveraged a long and strong relationship with not only the airlines in China, but the government of China and the Chinese nationals that support and work on Rockwell Collins equipment.
Kent Statler, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer.
Could I just ask Kent
question? Yeah, go ahead, Dick Mansbach.
Kent, to what extent have your operations been forced, and I use the word quite clearly, forced to share technology with the Chinese?
Well, Dick, if you look at over the last 25 years that we've been there, it's been more in a proactive means to position us for that growing, emerging market that we could see for some time. That was going to turn into really a truly global economic force. If you look at, in particular of the Chinese moving into organic development of their own aerostructures and the airplane, there's a COMAC 919 aircraft that has been announced. And in that, as part of the selection criteria was both the in-country work and in-country investment in research and development, and that was part of the selection criteria for partaking in that aircraft. So if you put that into underneath your term force, I think that is as close as I would say to what we've seen in the market. The rest has been a proactive means from us to position ourselves for that market as it continues to emerge. As they look at organic development, like any country, when they do organic research and development, they would like that to create jobs in their country. And with the C919, we will have two separate joint ventures between Rockwell Collins and companies within China to develop and the applications of that equipment for that particular airline.
Dick Mansbach, why is that interesting to you, this forcing of sharing technology?
Well, one of the real questions is what essentially are we forced to pay politically economically, technologically, et cetera, for admission to that market. And as I said at the outset of the program, at least on in politics, the Chinese are without doubt the most difficult folks in the world with whom to negotiate. And the conditions at, for American entry in various areas, for example, the problems we're now confronting with clean energy sources, the Chinese manipulation of the so-called rare metals area, which I think actually is going to rebound against them, have been serious sources of annoyance with this country.
Chad Hart is with us as well. I want to turn to you, Chad, Assistant Professor of Economics at Iowa State University, talking about trade, specifically in agriculture between the U.S. and China. Give us a broad picture of that trade relationship between the U.S. and China. For instance, it was announced during this visit, $45 billion in Chinese trade and investment. How much of that affects the agricultural picture?
Well, definitely when we look at in agriculture, China is a major player, a major trader with us. As far as rankings are concerned, they're our third biggest trader within the agricultural complex. Only Canada and Mexico are bigger, and they're right next door. And we've seen that agricultural trade build over the last decade dramatically. Especially in the case for Iowa crops, it's been soybeans where we've seen the biggest jump, if you will, in our exports to China. Now we're talking about multi-billion dollars worth of our product going into the Chinese market.
Mm-hmm. So what other trends have you seen? You said a huge rise in the building of soybean exports to China. What other trends have you seen in the agricultural relationship?
As far as the biggest trend, soybeans by far is the biggest one, but we're also seeing more meat demand within the Chinese economy, and they haven't had the capacity to produce as much meat to meet their burgeoning population down there. And so we've seen meat exports from the U.S. to China increase. We have shipped some cotton over into that market. And so we've seen the overall ag complex growing in value in terms of our exports to the Chinese market.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to some of our callers, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Ann is calling from near Cedar Falls. Good afternoon, Ann. Welcome to our program. Ann, are you there now?
This is Ann, yes.
Yes, Ann, we can hear you now. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. My question is, and my concern is, the amount of national U.S. national debt that the Chinese government holds, and essentially they're our banker, and what impact that would have on U.S. policy and the economy.
Okay, Ann, very good question. Dick Mansbach.
That's a wonderful question. I like to refer to that as mutual assured economic destruction. The bad part, of course, is that China and Japan hold vast amounts of American securities, which, as Ann says, has actually helped pay our deficit. This has allowed us to pay our deficit and maintain interest rates reasonably low, and maintain some semblance of strength to the U.S. dollar. Were the Chinese to suddenly, and I this is entirely improbable, but were the Chinese suddenly to start selling those securities, the U.S. dollar would collapse. Interest rates in this country would soar, and it would be economic devastation. The good side, of course, the mutual assured destruction is that if the Chinese were to do that, the value of their securities and their dollar holdings would also drop, as would, of course, American imports of Chinese goods. Essentially, that market would close.
In this relationship, though, does one or the other side have more political leverage? One would have seen the Chinese.
The Chinese have been recently trying to exert such leverage. They're talking, of course, about trying to make the yuan a reserve currency. They're talking about diversifying the nature of hard currencies in the global economic system. In other words, they're trying to diversify, to put it bluntly, to make themselves to give themselves greater independence and also to exert certain influence on this country. The answer, I think, and this was part of the Hu Jintao visit, that both China and Washington understand is a rebalancing of the global economy, which would mean Americans would save more and buy less and export more, and Chinese would save less, buy more from outside the country, and import more. If you had that rebalancing, which my guess is was one of the major topics that if the two leaders weren't discussing, certainly their aides were discussing, that's a gradual sort of thing. It has to be sufficiently fast so that at least people notice it, but it can't be so fast as to have a dramatic negative impact, for example, on the Chinese economy, with all the political implications that would mean for the Chinese leadership and Chinese and the authoritarian state and party.
Ann, thank you for that call.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Glenn in West Des Moines. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to our program. What's on your mind? Glenn?
Yeah, how are you?
Yes, we're hearing you now. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to mention that it seems that actually we've shipped all these pieces of technology and machinery to China so our corporations could buy the goods and make great profits and increase the stock prices. I wonder what your people think about us having anything to export to China that the people can buy, and whether we will ever get our manufacturing position back to be at least somewhat of a world leader. It's my opinion that we have lost that due to the loss of our manufacturing support base. That's all I have to say.
Chad Hart, let's go. Let's throw that one to you. In addition or besides agricultural goods, what do we have to offer China that it would be interested in, that it is buying? We have, of course, Kent Statler telling us about aviation technology.
Well, definitely, when you look at U.S.-China trade, agriculture has been a lead, but we also do tend to ship chemicals. We do tend to ship computers back to them, if you will. So there is a two-way trade there that is basically on a break-even basis with China when you look over those categories. They rely upon us for some of the raw goods that they process as they go forward. Also, they rely upon us for some of the technical expertise, if you will. The U.S. economy is built more on ideas anymore than it is on the manufacturing of the products. And so it is our, if you will, human capital that we tend to export to other countries.
Chad, can you imagine a time in the near future when China will not need any U.S. agricultural imports?
To tell you the truth, no. When you're looking at a land base like China, they have nearly 20% of the population, over 13% of the land mass, but only 5% of that land mass is arable, meaning that they are very limited in terms of their crop production just due to the geography of the country. On the other hand, U.S., 5% of the population, and we sit on 13% of the arable land. So we have that, if you will, inherent natural advantage in agriculture due to our location.
But you should note that China's trying to reduce that dependence in part by purchasing large swaths of land, especially in Africa and other arable regions, which have become essentially plantations overseas.
Interesting. Kent Statler, How long is it has Rockwell Collins had a relationship with China in China? How long was that?
About 25 years.
Now, how do you go about developing a business relationship with the Chinese? Is it any different than a business relationship with people in other countries?
Well, honestly, we find the Chinese to be very intelligent, very business adept individuals that. I would say that if there was something that differentiated working with the Chinese is strong relationships, and it is something where trust has to be built, that there's a relationship of, is this a person or is this a leadership team that I can trust and that I want to build with as I look forward in time. And once that threshold's been made, then how can we work together and do business? So where if you're working with a traditional, I'll say, U.S.-based customer or a capitalistic nation around the globe, you may start right with business terms, business conditions. The Chinese are one that you have to invest in over a period of time. You have to build those relationships. You have to build trust. You have to build joint roadmaps of what is in it for both parties, both yourself and for them as you look at going forward together. So I would say very sophisticated, very much focused on strong long-term relationships, and then very similar to the other customers that we deal with.
Tell us a little bit more, Kent, about the actual electronics that Rockwell Collins produces that would be found in these planes produced in China.
Well, we will have all of the communication, navigation, and surveillance, and by surveillance I mean detection of both weather hazards and other aircraft on the airplanes, along with the in-flight entertainment that will be on the planes, and the cabin management things such as lighting controls, audio controls, and that nature. So communications, navigation, surveillance in the cockpit, and then the cabin management, the lighting controls, things like that, along with the in-flight entertainment in the cabin.
So how important is the expansion in China to the future of Rockwell Collins?
Well, I think both tactically with the positions we've won on C-919, you know, obviously there's growth that's tied with that aircraft enters into service towards the end of the decade. But more importantly, I think strategically. I mean, if you look at, you know, the thing that drives air travel is middle class and the size of the middle class and business travel. By the mid-20s, 2020s, it's seen that China will be surpass the United States in GDP and economic prowess, if you will, in the market. So being part of that market for the long term, establishing those relationships, establishing those positions, enables Rockwell Collins truly to serve a global marketplace in the most efficient, effective, and also in the best interest of not only the customer but our shareholders.
Kent Statler of Rockwell Collins. Now, we all know that Rockwell Collins produces high technology, also used in military. What considerations does do you as a technology producer, as a defense contractor, have to take into account? I know we're talking about civilian airlines here too, but some people might wonder, is it what considerations do you have to take when you're sharing technology that you don't harm or potentially harm U.S. national security?
Well, absolutely. That's of critical importance to us, and I would tell you that the Department of State and Commerce does a very, very good job and thorough job to make sure that either technologies that are solely for government use are not exported, or technologies that are dual use, used in both the commercial military airspace, must be approved by the State Department before any of that could be exported, and in most cases, they are not exported.
Mm-hmm. You were watching Kent Statler this visit, and as we close down our program, I'd like to go to each of you and tell me something we didn't know about this visit that you'd still like to share within this hour. Kent Statler, what were you most interested in when you saw the Chinese president here this week?
Well, I think the ongoing relationship between where we've gone from, you know, the last 20 years of the United States being almost a unilateral world power to truly the rise of an emerging at least equal economic power, and the realization that we must work together, we have to respect what each party brings to the table, and we must have a path forward of how we optimize and take into account each other's interests as we look forward at the marketplace as we move forward. And I was encouraged by the dialogue that came out. I would tell you that it's the beginning of the dialogue. It's not going to do anything but continue to accelerate. It's not going to do anything except continue to grow. And the need for close alignment and close understanding and close working together is going to be paramount as we work with the Chinese going forward.
Chad Hart, very quickly, a few seconds, how has the Chinese president's visit affected agricultural trade, if at all, that you can see?
Well, in this case, I think with agricultural trade, the visit just showed that relationship has been strengthening over time. We're seeing it being more formalized. But the one thing I'm looking at on the agricultural perspective is there was a lack of discussion about the currencies between the two countries, and that was a hole, if you will, that agriculture was looking to see how that would be addressed over the next few years.
And Dick Monsbach, we have a few seconds, just under a minute. So what would you like to add that's still on your list that hasn't been mentioned?
Well, let me just add one thing. We've been discussing this as a bilateral relationship, especially economically. Of course, we're in a globalized world. Most of what, in fact, we send to China doesn't come back here. It then goes through China, and it goes to a third market and a fourth market and a fifth market. And indeed, these integrated the integration of corporations in terms of production and in terms of distribution and the like suggests that for both parties, the United States, China, and others, any effort, any conflict, while it may yet occur, and I'm not as optimistic as some, but while it may yet occur, nevertheless would be immensely costly to destroy. I mean, the relationship would be just immensely costly, not just for the two superpowers, but for a host of other countries.
Dick Mansbach, Chad Hart, Iowa State University, Kent Statler of Rockwell Collins. Thanks to the three of you for joining us this hour and giving us different facets of the U.S.-Chinese relationship. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Jeff Schmidt. In Ames, we had help from Nathan Clegg. And the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.